This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, attorney Abdin Jabara talks about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi.
The murder, it seems clear, was directed and perhaps supervised by the current prince, Mohammed bin Salman, the current prince of Saudi Arabia, which has caused American relations with Iran, Israel, and Saudi Arabia to come apart. How much? We don't know.
Environmental lawyer Kelsey Skaggs tells us about a recent victory in the case against three environmental activists.
What the environmental activists did was quite amazing. They closed down a pipeline for a whole day, and then they got away with it because people are sympathetic.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
This much has become clear. 33-year-old Saudi Arabian Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman knew of or directed the gruesome torture, murder, and dismemberment of Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi at the Saudi consul in Istanbul on October 2nd. The U.S. has had an alliance with the Saudi theocratic monarchy since it was forged by President Roosevelt in 1945 at the end of World War II. The United States needs Saudi Arabia to help rule the Middle East. It needs their cooperation in keeping oil prices low. It needs their petrodollars, their arms purchases, and it needs Saudi Arabian support for both its planned war against Iran and its support for a joint Israeli-American planned effort to permanently repress the Palestinian people, an effort which Trump has put his son-in-law Jared Kushner in charge of. But with the murder of Khashoggi, the U.S.-Saudi alliance is becoming frayed. We speak today with attorney Abdin Jabara. Jabara is the former president of the Arab American Anti-Discrimination Committee, a leader of Palestine solidarity work in the National Lawyers Guild, and a former board member at the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Abdin Jabara, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
What do we know, really, about the murder of Jamal Khashoggi?
Well, we know that he first visited the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on the 29th of September. And then on October the 1st, a team of about 15 Saudis came into Istanbul on private planes, and they began preparations for a second visit by Mr. Khashoggi to the consulate on October the 2nd. We are told that they made a survey of a wooded area nearby, and after he entered into the consulate, he did not come out of the consulate. In fact, a lookalike who was dressed in his clothes came out of the consulate, went out, and was photographed, of course, doing that. And when he did not come out of the consulate, his fiancée, who had been waiting outside of the consulate with his two cell phones, became very worried. And she contacted a friend of Mr. Khashoggi, who was also close to Erdogan, and a effort went out to search for his presence someplace in Istanbul, and he was not found. So what we know is that the Saudis at that point took the position that he had left the consulate, and it was only later that they ultimately admitted that he had died in the consulate, and they claimed that he died in an altercation, a fist fight. And but the Erdogan government, not Erdogan himself, but the intelligence agency, kept leaking information that they developed in their investigation to the press, which came into the international press, that demonstrated that he had been brutally murdered in the consulate. And just yesterday, Prime Minister Erdogan gave a speech in front of the Turkish parliament that laid out more details, saying that it had been a planned execution of Khashoggi and that it occurred shortly after he went into the consulate. There have been lots of changes of people's positions in this. Now, President Trump, who sent Mike Pompeo to see Prince Salman very shortly after this killing, and tried to work out some kind of an arrangement about how this would be handled. He also sent Munchen, who also met with Prince Salman. There's been a changing scenario as this whole thing developed. Many of the Saudis had developed this conference to help promote investment in Saudi Arabia, and many Western companies and American companies pulled out of that. It's being held as we speak. President Trump has now come, I think, quite far in pointing fingers in this case, because his initial position was, well, it may have been a rogue operation. He now says, well, when asked whether who was involved in this, he says he does not think that King Salman was involved and knew about it, and he probably didn't, because it's said that he has Alzheimer's disease.
The king, the prince's father.
Yes. But when asked whether the prince himself was involved, he said, well, he's been in charge there, and he certainly should have known or would have known. So that's as far as that has come. So this is really a big development. I think that the Americans now are in the position of trying to mediate a solution to this between the Turks and the Saudis. Prince Salman today made a statement that he hopes that this will not be he said there will not be a breach between Turkey and Saudi Arabia over this. Erdogan spoke today, but Erdogan is being very tough on this. He's calling for an international investigation. He's calling for the people who were responsible for this to be tried in Turkey under Turkish law. So he is not letting up on this. He's being very, very forceful in his pressing on this in terms of the Saudis. Whether this is being done to work out some kind of an arrangement to help Turkey, which is facing some financial difficulties now, we don't know. But it's certainly developed into a major, major international affair.
Well, there are audio tapes, the existence of which had been confirmed by people in the Turkish government. There are audio tapes of the murder. It's believed that Khashoggi's fingers were cut off before he was killed. One of the 15 members of the hit team was a forensic doctor who brought a bone saw to the operation, and they have audio tapes of all of this. And then I also read that the body was dismembered while Khashoggi was still breathing. So the whole thing is horrific, and the Turks are holding back on releasing this audio tape.
Exactly. That's exactly true. And in fact, the Turks have been very careful not to accuse Prince Ibn Salman publicly. So, but they have been leaking, and they've been playing this very, very carefully. It's been a drip, drip, drip leaking to keep this thing alive by the Turkish government. And so there's some geopolitical issues that are involved here. You have to remember that what is now Saudi Arabia at one time was under the suzerainty of the Ottoman Empire. And of course, that Ottoman Empire was broken up by the British and the French, and that there is now a huge ongoing struggle as to who would be the dominant players in the region. The Saudis, of course, had a transactional relationship with the Americans after 1945, whereby they were to be left alone to run their country however they wanted, which was basically a theocracy, a very closed society, a hermetically sealed society that did not allow any kind of outside cultural influence to come in. And it was really a very stultifying environment. And that was fine with the Americans as long as this transactional relationship was maintained. So they had a totally different relationship with Saudi Arabia as an ally than they did, say, for instance, with Israel, which was much more integrated into the American international control system, because they could claim that Israel shared values with the United States, et cetera. But as far as the United States was concerned, these Saudis were just a bunch of ragheads with money. And that's what they used them for. The Saudis helped fund, for instance, the Contras, because the Americans asked them to do that. The Americans would go to the Saudis to fund X or Y off the books so that they didn't have to go through Congress. So they had this relationship where there was a symbiotic relationship where the Americans helped protect the monarchy, and the monarchy helped protect American interests.
Abdin, how did the prince come to power?
Well, he was a vice. In the kingdom, they have the person who has been agreed to be the king, and that king is chosen by consensus. There are about 7,000 princes in Saudi Arabia, and of these, about 200 are the really important ones. And these 200 occupy the most important positions: the minister of this department, the governor of this government, etc. About 200 of them, and the king is chosen by consensus among these powerful princes. This king, Salman, was the successor to Prince Abdullah, who had been the previous king, and he had what is called in Arabic a wali al-ahd, which means a successor to the throne. They always have a successor to the throne, And that was Prince Nayef, who had that position. And he was removed by the king, by King Salman. In his place was put King Salman's son, who's Muhammad ibn Salman. And that happened in April of 2017. And then he began this process of really incredible changes in the kingdom. Some of them were cosmetic changes of liberalization, you know, allowing women to drive, opening cinemas, allowing a woman to sing publicly, a number of different things that were done, which looked like very promising. And I think what he wanted to do was to present himself as a modernizer. But at the same time, he rounded up some dissidents and put them in prison. He rounded up 200 top businessmen, including some princes, and held them hostage until they would give up some of the money that they had accumulated. He prosecuted this war in Yemen, this bombing of Yemen that has led to incredible starvation. He helped to continue the isolation and blockade of Qatar. And most importantly, was the ongoing and relentless attempt to brand the Muslim Brotherhood as a terrorist movement. Now, this has been an ongoing situation by the Saudis, and this is very, very important in this whole Khashoggi matter, all right? Because the Muslim Brotherhood, is basically mainstream in the Middle East. They have members of parliament in Jordan and in Kuwait and in Tunisia and Morocco. So it's kind of mainstream. And the Saudis tried to get all the interior ministers in the Arab League to brand the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization. And the Muslim Brotherhood had been supported by Qatar and by Turkey, all right? And the Saudis gave huge sums of money to Sisi, President Sisi in Egypt, to help him suppress the Muslim Brotherhood. And of course, we know about the overthrow of Mohamed Morsi, the elected president of Egypt.
What's the end result of suppressing them?
Well, the end result is that, you see, there's a real problem about legitimacy of governance in the Middle East. That is what the end result is. And they offer a particular program about legitimacy. But the Saudis want to be, they only want a non-politicized Islam. They want these quietist people that they control. Now, Prince Salman has pretty much gotten the religious establishment in Saudi Arabia under control. But there's been a lot of opposition to the government by some elements in the religious community in Saudi Arabia. So the end result is that we haven't talked about Iran here.
Attorney Abdin Jabara, who's been active in Arab-American politics for some 50 years, and we're speaking about the situation with Saudi Arabia. Abdin, Saudi Arabia is a rival of Iran in the region, and we'd like to talk to you about that because I think that the murder of Khashoggi really impacts that relationship.
Well, see, 1979 was a kind of a watershed year in the Middle East for Saudi Arabia for two reasons. Number one was the Iranian Revolution, and it was a revolution. It was a generally popular overthrow of an American-supported repressive regime, the Shah. This shook Saudi Arabia to the core. And the other thing happened that same year was an attack by some Muslim fanatics, if you will, on the Great Mosque in Saudi Arabia. So this was a challenge from the right, if you will, and a challenge from you might say the left, on the other side. The Saudis actually brought in the French to rout these people that had taken over the Great Mosque, and they executed everybody that they after that event. But they were shaken by it. And as a result of that, they became much more conservative religiously in the kingdom after that happened, so as to try to cover up the complaints of these people who had taken over the mosque. Now, with regard to Iran, what they did was they were afraid that Iran, and the Americans have constantly been telling them that Iran is going to come and try to take you over. They're going to try to take over the Gulf, those Gulf states, those small Gulf states, which are basically just a remnant of what the British had there and had set up. So they've been constantly telling them that the Iranians are coming and so forth, and so that those countries would buy American arms. Saudi Arabia buys 5% of Americans' arms productions. Huge quantities of arms, and that does not include what is bought by the United Arab Emirates. Iran has been used by the United States as a way to keep those countries in line and keep them beholden to the United States for their protection. Well, the Saudis and the Kuwaitis and the United Arab Emirates got Saddam Hussein to try to topple the Iranian government. It was the Saudis gave $25 million for that war, all right?
$25 million?
Yes. But there have been billions of dollars that came from those countries to help Saddam Hussein wage that war against Iran. And, of course, that led to huge, incredible losses of life. And then after the war, when they wouldn't help Iraq rebuild and give them funds, Iraq, of course, invaded Kuwait. And it was that point in time that America, the American part of the bargain with Saudi Arabia, came into effect, and the American Gulf War, first Gulf War, occurred because to help protect Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia saw itself on the chopping block of the Iraqis. So that is, in a nutshell, what's happened. Now, the neocons, of course, wanted to remove any kind of threat to Israel. And they, of course, targeted Iraq. They wanted to target Syria, although Obama was not as cooperative as they would have liked, because he never put American boots on the ground in terms of the Syrian civil war. But now that Trump is in power, they see a tremendous opportunity to do what Israel has been trying to do for a long time, and that is to get regime change in Iran. What has happened is that Jared Kushner has played a huge role in this. He is the one who got Donald Trump to make his first visit after he got elected to Saudi Arabia and built this relationship with Prince Ibn Salman. And the reason was is that he thinks that he can do this, continue this policy of getting various Arab states to make peace with Israel and isolating the Palestinians and forcing the Palestinians to accept just a modicum of any kind of a settlement otherwise. And Salman has been giving them the signals of this. He said the Jews deserve a homeland. He made that statement this year. Jared Kushner has been counseling Trump, all right, to not cut our ties with Prince Ibn Salman, because that's their man now in the Middle East.
Yeah, well, that's a man with blood on his hands. The New York Times of October 24th started off a lead article about him, and they talk about Prince Mohammed at that financial conference that he called Davos in the Desert. And he said, the article says, Mohammed bounded into the gilded conference hall of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel to a standing ovation from scores of oil executives, bankers, and other businessmen who had risked association with scandal over the killing of Mr. Khashoggi for a chance to profit from the kingdom's vast wealth. Well, there you have it. The amorality of it is just breathtaking. What do you think is going to happen? That's my last question, Abdin Jabara, because we're running out of our allotted time. What do you think is going to happen?
There's got to be some clarity on who was involved and punishment, etc. But I think that the basic American-Saudi relationship will continue, the one that existed before this. I think it will continue. I think because there's a mutual dependency here. I think the Turkey will have to receive some kind of recognition. But what I think also is that it may put a kibosh on the drive to overthrow the Iranian government. I think that's number one. And number two, it may put some brakes on the Yemen war. Those are two things that I think now are possible. And if those result from this, that's a great result. So I think those are two things that are on the table that I think. The Iranians have said that Saudi Arabia could not have killed Khashoggi without the Americans knowing about it and allowing it to happen.
I think that's true.
All right? So, and the, now the Americans may be trying to distance themselves from it. But they have a very close intelligence sharing, and they Prince Ibn Salman is a their man in Saudi Arabia.
He's also become known as Mr. Bonesaw, MBS. With that, Abdin, Heidi and I have to say goodbye to you, at least for now. And we want to thank you. Your edification of this complicated situation has really been helpful to us and to our audience. And Abdin Jabbar, we're so grateful for you to come on Law and Disorder Radio. Thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Earlier this month, a judge dismissed the case against three environmental activists who were charged with damaging a northern Minnesota pipeline in 2016. The defendants call themselves valve turners. They shut off the valves of two Enbridge Energy Company pipelines in Clearwater County to protest the oil industry's contribution to climate change. The action was part of a coordinated effort across several states. Like the defendants, their three-person legal team traveled thousands of miles to present their case in the small Northwoods town. The team consisted of Kelsey Skaggs from the Climate Defense Project in San Francisco and Twin Cities-based attorney Timothy Phillips, along with Oregon-based Lauren Reagan. State Representative Pat Garofalo said, quote, "Today's decision is irresponsible and sends the message that protesters are free to engage in reckless, illegal, and dangerous behavior that puts Minnesotans' safety at risk." He said, "This dangerous action needs to be corrected in the next legislative session." Judge Robert Tiffany dismissed the case at the defense attorney's request halfway through the second day of trial after County Attorney Alan Rogala rested his case. Tiffany granted the dismissal based on arguments from defense attorneys, one of which was that the prosecution failed to prove the defendants had damaged the actual pipeline, rather than merely the chains and locks bound to the pipeline valve. Enbridge Supervisor Bill Palmer testified that simply shutting off the valve would not have caused any damage to the pipeline. Joining us to discuss this court victory is Kelsey Skaggs, Executive Director of the Climate Defense Project. Kelsey, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Kelsey, did the original protest action cause any significant loss of production for the company?
Well, the original protest action, which was in October 2016, did disrupt the flow of Canadian tar sands oil into the United States for approximately an entire day. So in terms of pipeline shutdowns, that's pretty significant. In terms of what these massive companies like Enbridge are producing, it's a drop in the bucket for them.
I understand that a video was shown of the defendants that was filmed on the day of the incident. And it showed the defendants approaching the valve site, and then they called an Enbridge representative on the phone to explain what they'd done and why they did it. Do you think that video helped their case?
That's a great question, because the video was something that the defendants themselves actually put out in real time as they were doing the action. So they were at the valve site. They were live streaming what they were doing, how they were turning off the valve, and as you say, also recorded themselves calling in to give Enbridge information on what was happening. So it definitely does show that the defendants were at the site and that they were turning the valve on the pipeline. So one would think that it would support the state's case. However, in this case, the defendants were charged under a law that specifically criminalizes damage to a pipeline, and the judge found that there was not sufficient evidence to convict them of damage to a pipeline. So I suppose that although the prosecutor probably thought that the video was very helpful evidence, it didn't go far enough to proving the actual elements that the state had to prove under the charging statute.
We haven't actually seen the video, but we want to be sure to watch it. Can you describe, is the valve covered with any protection? Did they have to break into anything, or is it just out in the open?
On the video, you can't see a close-up of the valve. So it wasn't clear when it was shown in court or live-streamed exactly what the mechanics of it were because of the distance. But in terms of the actual structure, the defendants had to climb over a fence. They had to use bolt cutters to cut through a padlock and some chain like you could get at the hardware store. And that was it. That was the extent of the damage or impact to the site. And it seems that a key aspect of the case in court was that those things, the lock and the chain, are not the same as a pipeline, even though they're connected with this pipeline-related facility.
Kelsey, I understand that you were part of a three-person legal team. You all had to travel pretty far to get there. What was the energy company's legal team like?
This was a criminal case, so we were primarily dealing with the state prosecutor, and I did not have any interaction with people from Enbridge, the pipeline company in this case, and nor did my co-counsel. In other similar cases, we've seen demands for restitution, for example, and involvement of that sort from representatives of pipeline companies, but we did not experience that in this case.
Kelsey, I wanted to ask you about what I thought was a brilliant tactical move you made, and that is raising the necessity defense. I wanted to ask you about what is the necessity defense, because I think that, you know, the Trump administration, Trump will sign anything that the oil and gas industry puts in front of his nose. And it seems to me that they're marching us right over a cliff and we don't have much time, and that therefore there has to be massive civil disobedience and actions like the kind that your clients performed. They said that they were going to do this to prevent a greater harm, which would really be the extinction of the species on the planet. So you raised the necessity defense. Talk to us about what it is and what happened to it.
That's exactly right. The climate necessity defense is based on an old principle of criminal law that says that if the defendant, in this case a climate activist, was acting to prevent a greater harm and can meet a couple of other criteria, then that is a justification for breaking the law, and it allows the jury to acknowledge that sometimes laws support an unjust system and people are justified in peacefully breaking those laws. So it's illegal, but it's also a moral argument, and it can be a very powerful way to explain to a jury and the public an act of climate civil disobedience and why that is necessary and sometimes the right thing to do. So a defendant has to show that they acted to prevent an overwhelming harm, a greater evil, and as you say, global climate change and everything that goes along with that certainly qualifies. You also have to prove that you didn't have any lawful alternatives, but there was nothing within the legal system that the defendant slash activist could have done that would have been as effective as civil disobedience. So in this context, the political system has completely failed to respond to climate change. Corporations and business groups, not ordinary Americans, have dictated the government's response to climate change. So the lawful means that are available to citizens have not worked, and it would be unreasonable, really, to expect them to work at this point. So we had expert witnesses, folks lined up, including climate scientist Jim Hansen, Bill McKibben, who founded 350.org and knows a lot about trying to get climate policy through, a local physician talking about health impacts, and many other experts to speak to these elements of the necessity defense. So we were prepared to present this case. As it happened, the acquittal came so early that we didn't need to, but I think it would have been very powerful.
Yes, Kelsey, I wanted to address that point. The judge ruled that these expert witnesses couldn't testify on the effects of climate change, saying it would prejudice the jury. But isn't that, doesn't it really go to the heart of the necessity defense? You have to show what that greater harm would be.
That's absolutely correct. The procedural back and forth is that in October 2017, the judge issued a written ruling allowing us to present the climate necessity defense. And on that basis, we prepared all this expert testimony, which would typically be part of proving that defense. And climate science and climate change data is an absolutely central piece of that. And then the week before the trial was set to start, the judge issued another order essentially walking back that first ruling. And while he didn't exclude any of our experts by name, he said they cannot testify to global warming or climate change, and they cannot testify about civil disobedience, saying that the jury could make up their own mind on those things. And it was a very, it was a baffling decision in light of his previous grant of the necessity defense. One of the most frustrating aspects of it was this question of science versus belief. And in our response to this order, we cited data from the Yale Center for Climate Communication saying that roughly half of the people in this county from which the jury was drawn think that climate change is human caused. So this is clearly the kind of question where, you know, we need some climate science, but the judge specifically responded to that by saying that just because these potential jurors don't believe in climate change, it doesn't mean that we need expert testimony on it. It just means that their beliefs are different from those of the defendants. And to me, that puts us squarely in alternative facts land, and I think that it was an inappropriate exclusion of expert testimony.
Why do you think the judge walked back his original really heroic ruling? Why do you think he walked it back?
That is the question that everybody has been asking. I wish I knew. I don't have any inside information on that, unfortunately.
Well, Kelsey, despite that, there has been an increasing national press coverage on environmental activists involved in coordinated acts of civil disobedience, including in this case Johnston and Klapstein. I understand a writer from Wired magazine was present for the proceedings. Do you feel that this case added significantly to public awareness?
Absolutely, I think so. And it can be hard to know how to think about it when there's so much legal back and forth. But I think that it has brought greater awareness to climate change and what people are doing about it, climate civil disobedience, and to that as a response. And it was a very dramatic case, just not in the way that we expected. The acquittal at an early stage of the case by the judge is a legal victory. So in a criminal case, of course, the state or the prosecutor has to prove what the defendant did. And this acquittal by the judge means that the state's evidence wasn't even good enough to go to the jury. No reasonable jury could possibly have found them guilty. And it's important to remember that they were charged under one of these anti-protest laws, these laws that the fossil fuel industry has been promoting that provide for, in this case, felony consequences for actions around a pipeline. So it takes what would otherwise be probably a minor charge normally associated with protests, like misdemeanor trespass, and turns that into a felony. And there's also been a lot of attention, rightfully so, around these anti-protest laws or critical infrastructure bills, as the industry calls them. And I think one takeaway from this case is that law is not a good fit for peaceful protest, and the prosecutor wasn't able to prove that they had broken that law, even though these defendants admitted to going onto the site, turning off the valve. They happily admitted to it. They live streamed it and shared it. So I think that is perhaps a good sign in terms of the options for prosecution under those laws.
That's an excellent point. And as you were talking about that, I was thinking of the National Park Service in Washington, D.C., coming out with proposed rules that would severely limit protest in the nation's capital by, among other things, charging protesters fees for cleaning up, for services that the Parks Department has been providing historically for years. So I think we're seeing attacks on protest from the kind of regulations you just mentioned to what's happening in D.C., and I'm sure that if those regulations pass, we'll start seeing the states adopting similar ones.
Yeah, that's another interesting new angle. So they've already increased penalties, and now these additional fees. Yeah, it's not a pretty picture.
Kelsey, can you describe what it was like in the courtroom when the decision was announced?
In the courtroom when the decision was announced, people were very surprised. We were all surprised, all three of the attorneys. And you have to understand where we were at procedurally. The prosecutor had just finished presenting their case, and we made a motion for judgment of acquittal, which defense attorneys regularly make and which is very, very seldom granted. So we did not expect it to be granted, honestly, nor did our clients, nor did anybody in the packed courtroom. We made the motion, and the judge responded with a lengthy statement. It seemed that it was something written out that he was reading, and it went on, and I thought at one point, this seems unusual, but I still at that point didn't think that it would be granted. And so when he finally got to the part about the critical part, saying this evidence is insufficient, there were some audible gasps. It got really silent. Everyone was still. And he continued on for a few more sentences. And then as he finished, everyone began cheering and people were crying and people were very excited. And it was a lot of emotions all at once. Primarily surprise.
Attorney Kelsey Skaggs, you're the executive director of the Climate Defense Project. Do you have any other cases in the pipeline like this where the necessity defense will be put forward?
Pipeline said, no pun intended.
Right. There are a few ongoing cases, actually, in which defendants are either presenting or trying to present the necessity defense. One is happening right now in Cortland, New York. That's ongoing. It's before a judge rather than a jury, and it was continued approximately a month ago and is resuming later this fall. And then there is a jury trial that will take place in Spokane, Washington. And the judge had said that the defendant could present the climate necessity defense, but the state then appealed that ruling and is trying to get it overturned. So it's unclear when the trial will take place. And in general, I think we will see more of these cases as activists are starting to think about how to use this argument when they are designing actions and thinking about trying to engage with the legal system proactively, which is more and more critical now that the other branches of government are so inhospitable to talking about climate change.
Kelsey, how can listeners read for themselves more about your work at the Climate Defense Project?
We have a website, climatedefenseproject.org. There are updates in the updates and press pages about all of our recent cases. We also have a resources page that has a lot of information about using the climate necessity defense for activists and for attorneys and some of the filings in our recent cases. And I encourage people to check all of that out and feel free to contact us as well, also through the website.
Kelsey, if I might ask you a personal question, how did you get involved in this kind of legal work?
Sure. I have been involved in climate and environmental work and also organizing and activism for quite a while. I grew up in Southeast Alaska, and at this point, everybody has something they love that's impacted by climate change. And for me, being from Alaska, which is really on the front lines of climate change, I realized that early and felt like I needed to do something to protect my home. And also realized that climate change affects and compounds all of the other social justice issues that I really care about, because it primarily and first impacts people who are already marginalized by our social and economic systems. And in practical terms, I started working on climate law as a law student. I met my two co-founders at Climate Defense Project in my first year of law school. In my second year of law school, we started doing sit-ins on campus to try to get Harvard University to divest its endowment from fossil fuels. And also while law students, we sued Harvard University over those investments and started working with organizers in the community around Boston, and really realized from them that there was a need for attorneys to think about climate law in a movement-focused way. Finished law school and got our bar licenses and started the project.
You mean you got out of law school and you just opened up this law office to do this kind of work? You were like 24, 25 years old? That's terrific.
Yeah, right out of law school.
That's terrific.
Congratulations.
Yeah. I guess in these times you don't need a whole library full of books or an office to house them in. You need a printer and a computer, and you're in business, right?
Exactly. I'm sure it's much easier. But also in these times, we don't have time to wait. We have to be working on this right now.
Excellent point.
What's your office like? Give us a glimpse of what you do from day to day, you and your partners.
Well, a lot of it is sitting in front of a computer, writing or doing other things. So it doesn't look very exciting. We spend a lot of time working together. The three of us are a very close team, and I think that makes a difference in terms of being able to start a project like this and do something new, and also in terms of the quality of our work. We travel, obviously, for cases and sometimes for events. We host legal interns here and really try to provide for people a way into the new field of climate law, because there are not a lot of opportunities for this movement-focused, climate-specific work. So we're trying to help people experience that and see what it's like to be this kind of a lawyer.
ClimateDefenseProject.org is how people can get a hold of you.
Kelsey, thanks again for your fine work and helping to bring these issues into the fore.
And when these other cases come up, please let us know, because we sure would like to have you back on Law and Disorder, Kelsey.
That sounds great. Thank you both very much. It's great to talk with you.
Take it easy.
Bye.
Law and Disorder has been broadcasting for nearly 13 years now. We started on WBAI in New York City and are now carried on nearly 100 affiliate stations across the country. We'd like to take a moment to thank them.
WBAI 99.5 FM, New York City. KRFP 90.3 FM, Radio Free Moscow, Moscow, Idaho. WRFN 107.5 FM, Nashville, Tennessee. KSOW 106.7 FM, Cottage Grove, Oregon. WYAP 101.7 FM, Clay, West Virginia.
KRFC 88.9 FM, Fort Collins, Colorado. WRCT 88.3 FM, Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. KWMD 90.7 FM, Kasilof, 104.5 FM radio, Anchorage, Alaska. WXOJLP 103.3 FM, Northampton, Massachusetts.
KEIF-FM 104.7 FM, Enid, Oklahoma. WPVM 103.9 FM, Asheville, North Carolina. ISPCA Radio, Indiana, online to Chicago. Motion Community House Radio, online.
WLRI 92.9 FM, Gap, Pennsylvania. WPRR 1680 AM, Grand Rapids, Michigan. WCRS 102.1 FM, Columbus Community Radio. 98.3 FM, Central Ohio. KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City, Missouri.
Free Radio Santa Cruz, WSLR-FM 96.5, Sarasota, Florida, KDX Internet Radio, KDX World Around Radio, Lorain Community College Radio, WHUS 91.7 FM, Storrs, Connecticut,
WJFF Radio Catskill 90.5 FM, WDRT 91.9 FM, Viroqua, Wisconsin.
That's where I used to go fishing with Michael Ratner.
WERU 89.9 FM, Blue Hill, Maine, 99.9 FM, Bangor, Maine, Redwood Community Radio.
KMUD 91.1 FM, Garberville, California. KMUE 88.3 FM, Eureka, California. KLAI 90.3 FM, Laytonville, California. Voice of Sacramento 88.7 FM, Sacramento Community Radio.
WWPM MediaNet, Nokomis, Illinois. Community Radio for Cape Cod, WOMR 92.1, Provincetown, Mass., where I grew up. WMHC 91.5 FM, Mount Holyoke College, South Hadley, Mass., where I did three semesters.
You dropped out.
KSER FM 90.7 FM, Everett, Washington.
WHUS 91.7 FM, University of Connecticut. Free Radio Olympia, Olympia, Washington. WCRS, LPFM, 98.3 FM and 102.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. KSKQ, 94.9 FM, Homegrown Radio, Ashland, Oregon. WAZU 90.7 FM.
WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Green and Columbia Counties, New York. WGCX 90.7 FM, Community Radio Green and Columbia Counties, New York. KSVR 91.7 FM, Skagit Valley Community Radio. KYRS 92.3 FM and 89.9 FM, Thin Air Community Radio, Spokane, Washington.
WQVR, The I, 1640 AM, Sandersdale, Southbridge, Massachusetts. WFTE, 90.3 FM and 105.7 FM, Scranton and Mount Cobb, Pennsylvania. Rochester Free Radio, WRFI, 91.9 FM, Watkins Glen. WINO, 89.9 FM, Odessa, and 88.1 FM, Ithaca, New York. WEFT, 90.1 FM, Champaign, Illinois.
Radio Phoenix, online community radio, Phoenix, Arizona. Boston Free Radio, Geneva Community Radio, your voice for many voices in the Finger Lakes. KAOS, 89.3 FM, Olympia, Washington. KWTF, Sonoma County, California.
Radio Free Kansas, Northeast Kansas. KABU, 90.7 FM, Community Radio, Portland. 100.7 FM, Corvallis. 91.9 FM,
Hood River. WSCA 106.1 FM, Portsmouth, New Hampshire. WZRD 88.3 FM, Chicago, Illinois.
KOWA 106.5 FM, Olympia, Washington. WRIR 97.3, Richmond, Virginia. KMEC 105.1 FM, Ukiah, California. KSVU 90.1 FM, Concrete, Washington. WXPI 88.5 FM, Williamsport, Pennsylvania.
KNSJ 89.1 FM, San Diego, California. KGHI 91.1 FM, Westport, Washington. Our Streaming Planet podcast. WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, D.C. KPFT 90.1 FM, Houston, Texas. 89.7 FM, Huntsville, Texas. 89.5 FM, Galveston, Texas. WOOL FM, 91.5 FM, Bellow Falls, Vermont. Black Sheep Radio.
KGIG 104.9 FM, Salida, California. KEUL 88.9 FM, Girdwood, Alaska. KRDILP 103.1 FM, Duval, Washington. WUMD 89.3 FM, University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. KWRKLP 90.9 FM, Alaska Peace Center, Fairbanks, Alaska.
WGRN LP 94.1 FM, Columbus, Ohio. WOOC 105.3 FM, Troy, New York. WHYR LP 96.9 FM, Baton Rouge Community Radio, Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And Workforce Rising online. KBFG 107.3, Seattle, Washington. And KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
And we'd like to extend a special thanks to KNSG 89.1 FM in San Diego, as well as KGHI 99.1 FM in Westport, Washington.
WMNB LP 107.1 FM, North Adams, Massachusetts.
KODXLP 96.9 FM, Seattle, Washington.
KKRN 88.5 FM, Round Mountain, California.
KBFG 107.3 FM, Seattle, Washington.
WEJPLP 107.1 FM, Wheeling, West Virginia.
That's on Mondays at 7 a.m. and Friday at 7 p.m. And finally, the Progressive Radio Network on Wednesdays at 5 p.m. If you're not on this list and would like to be, please contact lawanddisorder.org, our producer Jeff Brady, so we can count you among our growing list of stations, and we'll notify you of upcoming programs and specials. Thank you.